Guys, hear me all right? Good afternoon. My name is Rui Maximo. I hope you don't get into an afternoon slump after a big lunch. So I'll try to keep you as entertained as I can. So this session here is about Link server security. So if that's not the session you want, please feel free to step out and go to the correct session that you're interested in. So with no further ado, let's just jump in. So Link server security. That's what I'm going to talk about. Hopefully, you'll get out some good tips and tricks for what to do and for looking at it. Link server is a particular beast, if you will, because unlike other, the majority of the applications that are out there, most applications dish out information, right? So there usually is a back-end database that has information, and then it's consumed some way or another by consumers or whoever the end users are. So it could be over a mobile phone or through a website or through an application. But that's kind of the traditional model. For Link server, it's different because it's actually a communications application. So it's an enterprise communications application. So there's really the information that you're sending is not from the back-end database. It's actually between users, right? It's a communication device. So with that, it's a little bit different when you look at in terms of security. So we're going to examine security protections, that Link server provides out of the box so that you don't have to go and look for solutions because there's already available. So we want to make sure you don't waste your time and looking for stuff that's already there. Maybe let's just identify some of the potential security gaps and then examine external user authentication. I think that's kind of where I'm going to focus a lot of the attention in because from my experience in talking to customers who've always brought up, they're always concerned about, hey, I got users, the internal, but they want to be able to access it from home or from outside if they're consultants. I'm really concerned about, opening up my network to them. And then I'll close with some best practice recommendations. So how much security is enough, right? So that's a good question to ask, and I think it's usually a question we want to start with. Well, the answer is it depends. Well, it depends on at least three factors that I can think of. One is, what is important to you? So is it important for your communication to stay within the corporate network? Then, you might not want to deploy an edge server. If you want to allow, flexibility for your organization so they can communicate from wherever, anywhere they are in the world, then, you'll have to take those things into consideration. So the next question is, what is it that you need to protect? What are you protecting? So I like to think of a good example that I used to do about 10 years ago. I used to be the security program manager for the first Windows phone, that smartphone that Microsoft came out. This is a long time ago. Code name was Stinger. I don't even remember what the name of the product was at the time. But I had an old beat-up Nissan Maxima. It was an old car. And it was basically running on its last threads. And people in my building, I would just drive it into work and then just get out, close the door, and just walk into the building. I wouldn't even lock it or anything. And people would make fun of me. He's like, you're a security guy. Why don't you lock your car? And I look at him, and I say, I got nothing to protect. Go ahead, steal my car. It's worth more to me if you stole my car than it is to me having it in the parking lot. So you want to keep in mind as to what is important to you, okay? So, and then the next question is, once you've decided what is it that's important to you, what is it that you need to have protected? The next question is, how much are you willing to spend, right? Because you could spend a lot of money and have it fully protected, but unless you're an NSA or a government agency that has a lot of funding to do something like that, it's going to be pretty limiting, right? You're going to have to work within whatever budget you can afford. And so that's how it is. And that's usually how you want to position it to your executives. If they're saying, I want full protection, and then you go around and you turn around and say, sure, but it's going to cost you. So, you want to have that kind of conversation. So with that in mind, and hopefully that sets up a stage for the rest of the conversation here. So security. Security is as strong as its weakest link, right? So the question is, what is your weakest link? So you want to examine what it is that you're trying to do. You want to profile your environment and then see where your weakest link is. And that's also another way of calling it is, what's the low-hanging fruit? So usually when it comes to security, you want to protect the thing that is most vulnerable, right? And so the low-hanging fruit. Start with that, and then you move on. Don't start with something that is just obscure, that only a handful of people in the whole world would be able to take advantage, like, you know, a security hack or something like that. Start with something that's a low-hanging fruit. That will give you, you know, as much protection right away, and then move along that chain. You're always going to have something that's going to be the weakest link. And at some point, you'll say, well, I think I've gotten to the threshold that I need to be secure enough. Right? You always want to be secure enough. There's always that balance between security and usability. I mean, what would be the most secure environment? It's for me to set up a server. I unplug the network card or the network cable. I throw it into a vault. I lock it up, and I throw away the key. That's secure. Is it usable? Nah, not really. So you want to keep those things in mind. So what do you think, and this is going to be an interactive session, hopefully, what is the most common security weakness, do you think? Is it A, hackers? Is it B, network perimeter? Is it C, users? Is it D, databases? Or is it E, mobile devices? Who wants to go with A? No one? How about B? No takers? How about C? Woo, C. How about D? Anybody D? How about E? A couple. All right. You guys win. You said it was C. Exactly. It's usually your users, right? Because the fact that your users are always going to try something different, something maybe stupid, if I may say, and maybe something unpredictable. And so you want to safeguard your users from themselves sometime, right? So that's where it comes to be tricky. So let's talk about protecting internal communication. So let's start with the inside, and then we'll move outside, right? We'll talk about internal communication, and we'll go to the external communication. And again, I emphasize the point that this is about communication. Link Server is a communication platform. It does IM presence, conferencing, application sharing, audio, video conferencing, and of course, Enterprise Voice, which is your VoIP solution. So let's look at the internal access. So let's look on the left side is the business requirements, potentially, if you have that same business requirement. And then on the right-hand side is going to be the technical solution for that particular issue. So the question is server-to-server communication strongly authenticated and encrypted? Yes. So encryption is on by default. So there's, you know, multiple types of traffic that goes through. The first one would be signaling, and that is encrypted. That's going to be, that's SIP, that's going to go over TLS, or between, that's TLS when it's from client to server, and between server to server, it's going to be MTLS, which is what we call mutual TLS, and the SIP traffic is encrypted, and it's over TCP. We don't use UDP for that reason. The media, Thomas Minder earlier this morning talked about the media and negotiation of ICE. All that is encrypted. That's using SRTP, secure RTP. That's for the audio video. For conferencing, it's PSOM. For application sharing, it's RDP. All of those are encrypted. And then there's also web traffic that Link Server uses, and that's over HTTPS, over port 443. So all the traffic is encrypted. You're fine. You don't have to worry about it. Now, in order to have that kind of support, you'll have to deploy an internal internal certificate server. And I say you don't have to. You could certainly use public certificate, but it's really a hassle to try to do that, and it's expensive. So we just best recommendation is just set up your own private certificate authority and use that. Then you want to configure your link servers with the certificates, and they're used for server authentication as well as encrypting the communication channel. So server-to-server communication, they'll use the certificates to authenticate each other. So that means that if you are using Exchange EM in the case of voice, and if you are using Enterprise Voice and you're deploying that, you'll likely want to have a voicemail solution, right? Otherwise, your users will like, hello, hello, and they'll never get transferred to voicemail. So if it's using voicemail, it's going to be the solution there is going to be Exchange EM. And that Exchange EM server is going to have to get a certificate from your certificate authority that is trusted by Link and vice versa. Okay, so next question is user authentication configurable? All right, so what type of, let's ask first the question is what type of user authentication is available in Link? Well, Link supports Kerberos. It supports TLS DSK, which was actually introduced in Link Server 2010. prior to that, it wasn't supported. And TLS DSK, let me talk a little bit about that if you're not familiar with this acronym, is basically certificate-based authentication. I mean soft certificate. It's not a hard certificate like your smart card or anything like that. It's a soft certificate that is issued by the Link server to the user, and then after that, the user authenticates using that certificate. It's actually a quite strong authentication method. And then there is NTLM authentication. This is V2 authentication, NTLM V2. So that's on the SIP traffic. On the HTTP traffic, and I'm not going to talk about the media traffic because they have different types of authentication, but let's just talk about the SIP and the web traffic. On the HTTPS traffic, again, TLS DSK is supported, NTLM is supported, and basic authentication is supported there. Okay. All right. So what about the question of if you have a media gateway that does not support SIP over TLS? If it doesn't support SIP over TLS, meaning that the traffic, the SIP traffic, is not encrypted. This would be port 5061 if it's encrypted. If it's unencrypted, then it would be port 5060. Well, what you can do for a simple solution, and hopefully you don't have a gateway that doesn't support TLS, but in case you do, what you want to do is basically configure your mediation server with two NIC cards, network cards, and place the mediation server and the media gateway in a separate subnet, so that way no one can sniff the traffic between the gateway and the mediation server and basically listen to every communication that goes through out to the PSTN. What about firewalls? Do any of you have internal firewalls? Maybe I can see with a show of hands. Okay, quite a few of you, right? And would you agree with me that it is actually pretty painful setting it up, especially when you introduce a new solution? Yes, I see a lot of smiles here. Yeah, absolutely. It is a real pain. So hopefully we'll provide you some help here when it comes to Link, because obviously a communication solution is going to mean there's a lot of traffic. So we certainly recommend you to refer to the product documentation. There's a lot of content. Refer you to the protocol poster. I'll show you. How many of you have actually seen the protocol poster or know what I'm talking about? Oh, quite a bit. You guys like it? Yes? All right, good, excellent. And if you have feedback, anything that's wrong or anything that you guys want, please send me an email. I'll be glad to incorporate more information. And then Thomas Vinder is going to help me show an app that we developed. It's called the Link Firewall app that helps you define firewall rules. They're really a pain, right? Because what actually happens with firewall rules is that when you have an issue, what do you usually look for? You look for an error message, right? If you're looking, so you kind of look for through logs, or you're looking through an error message, and then you go from there, and then you try to find a solution. However, with a firewall problem, you get no error messages, right? It's just silent. You're sending out a packet, and you get nothing back. And you're like, what's going on? And you're digging around, and you're looking for an error message, but you don't find it. And then after 24 hours of searching and debugging, you're like, wait a second, maybe it's a firewall issue. And it's usually the clue that will give you that idea is the absence of an error message or an absence of a response. But it takes a bit of a trained eye to recognize those situations. So it is a bit of difficult to troubleshoot those kinds of issues because, like I said, no error message. It's hard to really break it down. All right, protocol poster. So there's actually a new update, and I'm going to show you the latest one. It's on TechNet Download Center, so you should be able to see it. I'm not going to go through the whole poster, but I want to let you know that I did make some updates there. And the reason why I broke it down into multiple workloads is to help you see the difference in the usage of all the ports and protocols that are used for each workload. So, for example, if you're only deploying IAM in presence, you don't really care about application sharing, audio-video conferencing, and enterprise voice workloads. So you can just focus on that one. And you can see the differences. Something I want to just point out is the certificate requirements. Certificate is often, you know, an issue. It's kind of confusing or complex to set up. So I provide some guidance and some help there. Another thing that also can be a bit tricky is DNS configuration. So at the bottom left, there's some information there on how to, you know, help you configure it. It's certainly not comprehensive, but hopefully it provides some help. So actually, I've been working on another poster in the last weeks, last week, in response to actually another customer's request. And so I actually banged it out in about 14 hours. This is over 2 days. Not complete by any means, but certainly you guys are the first one to see it outside of, you know, just me and a few people that have seen it. And be curious to get your opinion on whether this would help. This is more of an architecture type of diagram. So it kind of helps to show what are the components that are running on each of the server roles. So something to point out over here is you can notice the front end server, which is kind of right center here, has a lot of components that are running on it, right? That's actually a tremendous amount of services that are running. You can see that for VoIP, it's not just one service, but there is a number of services that are running. For conferencing, there's also a lot of services running. And then you have CMS, which is a central management service that's running there, and then a bunch of other things that are there. So like I said, it's not comprehensive, but it is a start. And if you guys like it, how many of you think you like this? Do you think it's, oh, okay, great. All right, so I'll definitely make this available on the web then. Because right now is just living on my laptop and thinking, I don't know if anybody likes it or not. But if you guys do, I'll be glad to put it out there. I'm still trying to put more information and seeing what kind of information you guys like. It's a bit of a, shooting in the dark. Because I don't have a direct voice with you guys, it's hard for me to guess what you want, right? So if you would like to maybe after this session come up to me and say, hey, I'd like to see something in this poster, please let me know, because that really helps me and I can think about it and see how best to illustrate and put it on the poster. Anyways, let's move on and look at the Link Server 2010 topology. Now, I'm not going to go into much deep depth here because a lot of the other sessions have already covered it. But you can see there's a lot of different server roles that Link Server 2010 uses, right? You got the director, the front-end pool, the AV conferencing server, if you want to separate that out. You got the persistent chat. You got monitoring server, archiving. You got the mediation server. You got the exchange server, which is the exchange UM in this case. You got this SSBA, which is a survival branch appliance. And then on the network perimeter, you're going to need to have a reverse proxy. That's not a Link server role, but you'll still need one. You got the edge servers, and then you got the XMPP gateway. So a lot of different server roles. It's actually a pretty complex product, as I'm sure you all know. So there's a lot of communication going on between these servers, right? Now, for those of you who have internal firewalls, that gets to be pretty complicated. And so it's really kind of hard to figure out which ports to open internally to make sure that, your link will work. So to help you with that, I'm going to ask Thomas to come up here and help me with this demo. Hopefully this laptop is awake. Yes, it is. I'm going to switch to this computer. And is it up there? Yep, it is up there. So this is an app that I wrote about a month ago. And here, a little bit of background here is that Thomas Vinder, he actually used the protocol poster, and then he took all the details from it and put it in a spreadsheet. And he added more data, which the poster couldn't provide. And so that's a tremendous amount of work, something that I just wasn't willing to do myself because it just requires a tremendous amount of expertise. And Thomas did a great job putting that together. And so I did the next best thing, and that was to leverage his work and build upon that. And so I thought, well, the spreadsheet is a little hard to read. And actually, when I bring it up here, I'll show you what it looks like. And it's called the port requirements. And you can see that this is actually pretty comprehensive. There's a lot of stuff in here. It just keeps going and going. And so there's a lot of information here. And I'm going to close that. But I'm more of a visual person. That's why I like to create posters. And so I thought, well, creating a poster of firewall rules is going to be pretty static, and it's going to be pretty overwhelming to see all at once. So I thought, well, what if I broke down the firewall rules as a pairwise, meaning I just need to look at two servers or two endpoints, basically, and just see what all the firewall rules are there, right? Would that be an easier solution, Thomas?
Of course it will. So thanks, Rui. So I think the primary idea when we created the spreadsheet was that the poster you created gives us a lot of information about what component speaks to what other component. But it's all visual, and sometimes I really want to find out, well, I just need to filter what is the front end speaking to which other components in my environment, and what ports would be used. And while all this information is real in the poster, I just need to look at every little arrow I have there, look at the ports, and then create my own list. So what we're trying to do with the spreadsheet is really collecting all of this information. And I think the spreadsheet might be a quite good tool if you already know what's going on, but it will not really help you to understand what is going on. It's just more a documentation of what you already see. And I think the tool does here a great job in me just selecting one specific component, seeing what other components this component is talking to, and then seeing the ports required from this component to this other component. So if you will, it's kind of a zoom into the workload poster where I would isolate one single component and see all the connections coming from there.
That's great. Do you want to show us how that all works?
Sure. Now if we look at the application at the very left side, we have our source. So on the source, I have the list of all the components that I could have in a link environment, and I can specify, I want to see now all the connections that, well, for example, a front-end pool is issuing to any other components. Now, I'm looking at the very right side, looking at all the...
So on the right-hand side here on the destination port, is it listing all the link server roles or only the ones that...
Yeah, and that's already one of the things that helped me a lot, because it lists only the components that the front-end server is communicating to. So if the front-end server is not communicating to a specific component, I will not see it there. For example, if I, in contrast to the front-end server, I just choose the archiving server, I can see the archiving server on the right-hand side is really talking only, establishing outbound connections only to the SQL server where the archiving database is hosted. So just by looking at these two columns, I already understand who is talking to whom. So going back to the front-end pool. Now I'd be interested, what kinds of connections does a front-end pool, for example, have to an archiving server? So here I can see the front-end pool. If it needs to talk to an archiving server, it will use TCP 1801. And these are the ports that I now need to open on the firewall. And I can go on. I can see, well, what about AV conferencing servers? I can see here all the ports that are required to open between these two servers, from the front-end to the archiving server. And at the bottom, I do have a list giving me more information. The protocol, the source port if defined, destination ports. If it's encrypted, I will see the purpose. It gives me the information if I can configure it. And there is a link to documentation so that I can learn about this specific port.
That's great. So it just works with all the different ones. And because it's basically this app is driven by the spreadsheet, and the spreadsheet comes with the application. If you want to configure it to do other things, to show other ports, it's easy enough to do that. And the plan is, in the future, is we're going to include also Exchange ports so that you can have one app and just have, you know, both Link and Exchange, because there's obviously going to be communication between the two products. And then we'll see where we go from there.
Sure. Well, Exchange UM is already included, so if you want to see what the clients or servers need to speak to communicate to Exchange UM, you can already see it there. And I think we're going to announce the download with the next hop block. And I really, if you use it, if you have any feedback, let us know if there's something missing, if you want to see something additional. We are happy to incorporate everything you want to see.
Absolutely. That'd be great. So, yeah, we'd love to hear from you. If this is valuable, do you guys like this thing, something you'd use? No? All right.
Perfect.
Great. Thank you. Good. Well, I'm glad, because that's what it's for. It's for you guys to use it. If it'd be a shame if we built something nobody was interested in. So, great. Thank you, Thomas. All right. So that's the app, and hopefully this is going to help you. I've actually demoed this also at TechEd USA a couple weeks ago and got really positive feedback on it and some ideas on how to improve it even further. So I'll try to do that as well. Just like with the posters, I like to start with something that actually is useful to you guys and then continually try to improve it so that it really helps your life as administrators and architects in building out Link. It's all about shortening the deployment cycle of Link within your organizations. Hopefully that will do for you. All right, so this is available, and I'll actually show you where it is. So we're back over here, getting confused with so many computers. All right, there's a link in the spreadsheet for where you can download it, and it'll come up pretty soon. So the next step is we talked about internal communication. Now let's talk about external communication. And this is probably where you're more concerned about, right? Because internal communication, even if all the traffic was unencrypted, you're still protected, right? Because you have a network perimeter and it's pretty good. But but when it comes to external communication, that's where the concern really comes into play. So I'm sure you guys are afraid that your firewall is going to look something like this, right? Like a Swiss cheese out there. So hopefully this is going to help you with the app and a good understanding of how users authenticate and log in through Link can help you avoid a situation like this. So let's look at some of the business requirements. Some of these may apply, some of these may not apply, but it's okay. So the question is, does your organization need to communicate with other trusted organizations? Well, if that's the case, then you'll definitely want to deploy a Link edge pool or edge server. I think we have some big mice up there that's running around, unless there's another floor. And then you'll want to configure federation types. Now, there's three different types of federation. These are not the exact names. I just shortened them up and just made some new ones because the real names are actually quite long. But you have closed federation where you say, I will only talk to you, and you will only talk to, or I will only talk to you, and that's it, nobody else. Another one is I'll make myself discoverable to others, but I won't talk to everybody. I'll only talk to select people. And then the third one is open, so if you can discover me, I can discover you, and we can talk to each other. This requires also configuring public certificates. Now, I say public because that means that you'll need to get a certificate from a public CA. You'll have to configure your external DNS. I'm not going to go into details of the configuration. That's, you know, there's a lot of good documentation for that. That's not the purpose of this talk here. And then once you do that, all communications are encrypted by default. So there is no way that Link would allow you to have a communication that is unencrypted. So it is all encrypted. Next is, do your users need external access? I mean, do you allow your users? Actually, maybe you can show me with a show of hands how many allow or want to allow your users outside your corporate. Okay, a lot of you guys, right? So this would be pertinent to you for this. So yes, again, you'll need to deploy an edge pool or an edge server, and then you'll want to determine which workloads are needed. Okay, just with the protocol poster, you want to determine, are you only allowing IAM in presence? Are you allowing conferencing? Are you allowing enterprise voice? Because that will also determine which ports you want to open. So a combination of the protocol poster, the spreadsheet, and this app will help you determine which ports you need to open. If you're going to deploy enterprise voice, you'll need to open quite a few more ports than if you only had IAM and presence only. You'll also need to deploy a reverse proxy if you don't have one, or if you have an existing one, you can certainly leverage that. That's for all the web traffic that goes through. And then you can also deploy the XMPP gateway if you want to be able to interop with XMPP networks, such as the Gmail solution or Gtalk. Again, similar to federation, the edge servers need to have public certificates for server authentication and encrypted communication, and then you need to configure external DNS. Now, what about do users want to be able to invite external participants to web conferences? So, like, for example, maybe you want to invite a third-party partner or a customer to join a presentation that you're doing, that your users are doing. Well, if you don't want to allow anonymous access, then there is a setting inside Link to help you configure that. So, you know, leverage the functionality that is within Link to tighten the system for your purposes. Is defending against denial of service attacks and password brute force attacks a priority? Is that an issue for you? How many of you are concerned about that? Okay, a few of you. All right, so if you have that concern, I developed the security edge filter that's deployed on the edge server that allows you to protect against that. And it's a simple solution, just similar to the Active Directory account lockouts. Basically, you can specify the number of failed attempts you can do, and then after that number, it'll actually block further attempts to log in right at the edge without actually locking out the user in Active Directory, so that they don't get locked out of all the services within within your network. Same thing for the reverse proxy. Users can still be locked out by attempting too many logins. And by installing a security web filter on Forefront TMG, that will also provide that kind of protection there. All right. So let's look at the, I'm going to do here a demo on the security edge filter. And the reason I want to show this here is how many of you understand how Link Client logs in to Link Server? Maybe with a show of hands. Okay, a few of you. So if I get anything wrong, you know, please raise your hand. But what's interesting here is with Link Server, first of all, I'm going to show you here that my certificate store, I do have a lot of certificates, but you'll see there's no certificates from GoopTech. So I want to give a shout out to a friend, Fabian Kunz. I'm actually using his servers. They're actually in Switzerland, so they're closer by. And he's been nice enough to allow me to use his servers. So I'm terminal serve into them. And this is the Edge server over here. And basically, you can see here that I have a victim too. And I can successfully see that the user was signed in to Link Server. And so the other thing I was showing is here, so here there's no certificates from that domain. And in the credential manager, there's also no credentials for that particular user. So let's try to log in. And I'm going to try to log in as victim 2 from GoopTech. And what I did is actually I blocked NTLM authentication from the reverse proxy. And there's a reason why I did that. So here I'm getting prompted for credentials, right? Because I don't have any credentials in the credential store. I don't have a certificate in my certificate store. So I'm getting prompted for credentials. And so I'm going to put in an incorrect password. And I get denied. So we'll look over here, and I'm going to refresh here. And you can see there's a warning here that shows, oh, well, the user victim 2 from this particular IP address and the domain name is GoopTech victim 2 failed to log in once. Okay. Now, what's interesting here, and I want to make sure I highlight it, is I could attempt to log in, and let's try that, with a different SIP URI, and let's say I say victim 3. I'm sorry, say that again? Oh, that's right, change. That always throws me off. So, victim 3, and then it's going to attempt to log in after I click the sign in button. And I'm going to put the wrong password in there. So what I want to do here is actually change that. So I'm going to do GoopTech victim 2, put the wrong password, and it's going to fail to authenticate. Okay. And so what I'm going to show you here is that I can change the SIP URI. The SIP URI and the domain name credentials can be different. So what that shows is that a hacker could try all kinds of different SIP URIs, but it doesn't matter what the SIP URI, it's actually the domain credentials because the user is being authenticated using those domain credentials. So you want to be careful to not just key off of the SIP URI because if the SIP URI keeps changing, you'll never identify an attack. You want to identify the attack based off the domain name. And the domain name can actually be entered in multiple different forms, right? So you could actually the domain name can be, I don't know if you can see this, will be big enough, but so domain name could be domain/user, or it could be user@domain.com, for example, or it could be domain.com@user. So all these different forms are acceptable. And so one of the things you want to make sure is if the user attempts to log in using domain/user 3 times, and then they get locked out, and then they can try again with user@domain.com, and they get locked out 3 times after 3 times again, you can see that there's a lot of variation. So you want to be able to normalize all these different formats, the UPN and NetBIOS format, into a single format that can be used. So that's also important to look at. Okay. So now let's look at, let's log in. I'm going to change here again. Go back to victim 2. And now I'm going to sign in. And this time I'm going to put the correct password. So here it was just doing the default, and I got to sign in. It was using my local, oh, did I get locked out already? Oh, yes, maximum attempts already attempted. So now I'm locked out, regardless of however many times I want to log in. So we'll have to change that, and we'll go to victim 1. All right, so now I want to be careful to type in the password correctly. I don't want to get locked out. All right, what's going on? Okay. So, what's going on? Okay. So, now I'm logged in. And let's actually verify that. Yep. So you can see here that GroupTech Victim 1 is successfully signed in to the server. But wait a second. Why am I getting prompted again? Does anybody know why I'm still getting prompted for credentials? It's Exchange Server. That's right. It's the Exchange Server. And remember, I said something right at the beginning. I blocked NTM authentication on the reverse proxy. Right? So this authentication box is prompting me for credentials, and that traffic is going through the reverse proxy for verification. So if I were to say cancel, I'm still logged in. So I'm logged into SIP to Link, but I'm not logged into the Exchange Server through EWS. Okay? So now let me just log off. And what I'm going to do next is I'm going to change this false. Save that. And then I'm going to restart my forefront server. And this might take a little while. So I do have a script that I'm following. So I need to make sure I'm following my little script here so that I don't get lost. Oh, so now that I have logged in, the other thing I want to show is when I go back to my credential manager, I should see an entry here for victim 1. And I do. Right? It's right there. Okay. Now, you'll also see that there's victim 2 and victim 3, but their passwords are incorrect. Now, let's look at my certificate store, and this is going to take a little while for it to upload. So what we did is we blocked NTLM authentication at the reverse proxy. We failed the attempt to authenticate, and I could show you the failed attempts. The other thing I wanted to show you is to decode the NTLM type 3 messages, but I will skip that for right now. And then we successfully logged on, and I logged off, and then I'm showing you the credential managers here. So here you'll see, where is it? Should be. Is it the top? Oh, now I know. I actually remember. because I blocked NTLM authentication, I don't have a certificate, right? So that means I can't do TLS DS case authentication with that lock, with the NTLM blocked. But now let's go back to the reverse proxy, and let's restart that now. Now that I've unblocked NTLM authentication, and we will attempt to log in. Now, what do you guys think is going to happen when I try to sign in? Is it just going to sign in directly? Yes, why? Because the credentials are in the credential manager, right? But what type of authentication is it going to use? It's going to use NTLM because I don't have a certificate yet, right? So now I'm going to attempt to log in. And it automatically logs in, right? So we've already looked at the credential manager. And now let me refresh this. Where's the refresh button? There it is. Okay. So while that's doing that, let's take a look at the reverse proxy now. So here there's a bunch of information about the reverse proxy. I actually spew everything out. But let's go all the way down to the bottom. And one thing I want to point out is you see there's authorization here, NTLM. So I am, Link client is authenticating to the Link server web services over NTLM. Okay? So it's doing an authentication again. You can see over here that it was previously authorization was access was denied because I had blocked it. And then let's take a look further down. There's a bunch of information. Now, because I printed basically everything, so I'm having to scroll through and find everything that I need. So here, notice something. There is a request for a certificate. Get and publish certificates. And, oh, I'm too far up. We just passed it. So here is basically the certificate request. This blog over here. So you can see that Link requests a certificate over the web channel and not the SIP channel. In fact, there was a question like this two weeks ago when I was at TechEd. Someone asked me the question, like, does the client request a certificate for TLS DSK over the SIP channel or the web channel? And actually I said, well, I actually don't know. I never even tried it. So I tried it, and I basically blocked web traffic on the reverse proxy, and then I could see that, as we had previously seen, that the certificate store didn't have a certificate. So then when I went back and unblocked it, then the certificate happened. So you can see there's a certificate request. So actually, let's go back here and see that there should now be a certificate request. Where is it? Did it not get passed? So I'm going to refresh this again. Sometimes it takes a few times to get the certificate. But I should have now the certificate, and hopefully that will appear soon. Now it is. There it is. So you can see victim one has a self-signed certificate. Okay? And you can see that certificate was issued by the Link server. And so now with that certificate, let's try something else. So now let me log off from here. And then I'm going to go into my credential manager. And I'm going to delete the credential from the vault. And just for good sake here, I'm going to also delete these other ones that I don't need as well. Okay, so now that's all deleted. So now all I have on my client is what? A certificate. I don't have NTLM credentials, right? So if I log in now, I should be able to log in with just a certificate. Sure enough, I am logged in, but why do I get prompted again? I get prompted because of EWS, right? And that's why I get prompted for it, because it does require, it does want my NTLM credentials. But if I were to dismiss this, I'm able to sign in to Link with my self-signed certificate without having any NTLM credentials, any username and password on the local device. So for customers who have concerns about security and getting their passwords out there, especially if it's on non-issued, non-corporate issued devices, they really don't want customers to go, users to go in and put in their credentials on all kinds of devices, right? So this is a good way. If you lock down the computer, you say, okay, bring in your computer. They're at work. They're going to log in. They get the credentials, the certificate, and then you can either invalidate the password later on, or you could have a script to go and delete the credential from the credential manager. And then now they can go home, and they have a machine from which they can log into Link, but they don't need to put in any credentials. They don't have to put in the username and password. So the username and password stays secure because they have certificates. Now, if you wanted to make it even one step further, more secure, you could turn on BitLocker on the laptop, which is, you know, it's going to be a corporate-issued machine, so you can do basically whatever you want with it. So you can turn on BitLocker, and now your whole machine kind of becomes like a big smart card, right? Because in order to boot, you have to put, the user has to put in their password. They boot in once. The certificate is in there. They can log into Link. They don't have to type any credentials. So it's a nice way to keep your users secure and your network secure while still letting your users connect from the outside. Hopefully this was valuable and interesting to see. Okay, so let me make sure I've covered everything I want to cover here. Yep, I was going to do account lockout, but I'll do that later. So let's move back. And I like to create little diagrams here. So some of the key benefits here, really quickly, is it helps protect corporate domains accounts from external attacks. You can enforce stronger authentication by blocking NTLM authentication. Now, you don't have to use a security filter to block NTLM authentication, but it's one of the side effects. And it helps prevent attackers from consuming internal Link server resources, because when you log in from the outside, the authentication does not happen at the edge server, right? It actually happens at the directory or an internal Link server. So by blocking at the edge, it basically says, hey, you can't even knock, you can only knock at the door, but I'm not going to open the door for you. So, you know, it's nice for that way. And it doesn't require any external hardware for it. And that diagram there just helps to illustrate what it's doing when it protects the user. All right, so moving on. Is username and password authentication permitted for external users? So if you have that restriction that you don't want to allow your users to use their credentials, their NTLM credentials, username, and password, you can prevent that with Link. You can basically block NTLM authentication at the edge server. And you can use this PowerShell script to do that, or command. And basically it says for all edge servers, you can block, you set the use NTLM for client to proxy auth to false. And so it blocks NTLM authentication. Now, question is, what type of authentication can users use when they're external? Can they use Kerberos? No, they can't use Kerberos. So if NTLM is blocked, what's the only other option? TLS DSK. Yes, exactly. That's a good point. So the question was, if you block NTLM authentication, is there a loss of functionality? Yes. And you pointed out mobility services. I'll cover that a little later, but since you bring up the topic, all Link mobile clients use NTLM authentication through the web proxy. I don't know the answer to that question. So I don't know. So yes, it would block. Yes, sir. So the question is, with the security web filter, do you still need a director? It's orthogonal. Because the director directs SIP traffic, it's not going to direct the web traffic. The web traffic from the reverse proxy goes directly to the pools, to the user's pool, or to wherever the pool, the conference is hosted on. Okay. Yes, sir. What happens if you import, export user certificates? You can't export the certificate. So if I were to go over here and try to export it. Oh, sorry. Thank you, Thomas. So I just right-clicked on that certificate and go to All Task and go try to export. If I click Next, I don't have the option to say, yes, export the private certificate. So it is keyed to that particular laptop. So that's the nice part of it. So you can't steal the certificate and take it to another laptop and or another machine and use it. Okay. So back to the question about the mobility. Yes, you would lose some functionality there. However, you can say for link, for SIP traffic, you can block NTLM authentication, so that it only uses TLS. And then for the web traffic, which comes to the reverse proxy, you allow NTLM authentication. So you could do that. So that's a possibility. Okay. So here we talked about you can enforce BitLocker, certainly a good thing to do. I'm really excited about the next Windows 8. If you heard the announcement, Windows Phone 8, it'll have a BitLocker enforced there. So that's going to be really great. And then you can block NTLM authentication, forcing TLS DSK authentication on the Edge server, which I showed you on the previous slide. And to also block NTLM authentication on the reverse proxy, then you can use something like the security web filter for that. But again, keep in mind that web services or link mobile clients will not be able to log in. All right, let's take a look at the security web filter. So let's go back over here. And let's see, what is it that I want to cover? Okay, so let's take a look at the logs. And I'm going to clear up this log over here so it's empty. And let's attempt to sign in again. So now I'm going to get prompted. And you can see right here there's a bunch of output that already came. Okay? So a lot of it's going to be irrelevant, kind of, I won't say garbage, but one thing that's interesting to note is the user agent. So you can also see, just like in SIP, you can see what user agent the user is signing in from. So from here, you can see it's an OC client, so it's Link Server Link 2010, and then the key thing to look for is. So I'm being prompted, so there is no credentials that being asked. So right now I'm going to put in a wrong password, and it came back right away. So this time I'm going to put in the right password. And yeah, that's right. It's for Exchange Web Services. So you see there's no traffic there for the link stuff, for the web services. Let me show you from a web client. So if I were to go to the dial-in URL, and I put in the wrong password, and I attempt to sign in, you'll see a bunch of traffic again over here. And the thing to note is that I identified who the user is, group tech, victim one, and the IP address. So I was able to pull that information out. And the reason why I was able to pull that information out is because And you can see what the URL was over here and the user agent. So user agent, you can see that there's no OC. It's actually a browser. And it's MSIE, version 9 on Windows NT 6.1. And you can see the response here is internal server error. Okay. So now let's try to log in with the correct password this time. And let's go back here. All right, so that was it. And I should have cleared the logs beforehand. We'll walk backwards here. So you can see all this information that's coming out from the web service, from the reverse proxy. And one thing I wanted to show you is the body of the message. Now, if you see it, shout it out, because sometimes I can't. Search. Good point. And that was the first one. Response. I'm just going to clear and start over. It'll be easy that way. Okay, so clear this again. Oh, did I lose my connection? All right, we're back. And then here I'm going to sign in. Is it? Do a quick search. There it is. So right there, it sees the login, and then the response, which was 200 OK. And I want to show you. Is it right here? There's the user agent. Okay. And that covers it. So you can see from the reverse proxy, I can collect all the information, and I can either looking through the user agent, I can detect what type of client it's trying to log in from, and if it's what type of authentication it's trying to use. I was trying to show you that this was basic authentication, but I can't seem to find the field in it. But it's in there. I think I have a little too much output to show you on that one. Okay, so let's move along here. So again, features about the security web filter. It monitors every client login request, uniquely identifies the user login. So it actually normalizes the login domain name, whether it's domain./user or domain.com/user or UPN format. It enforces account lockouts, so it protects against denial of service attacks. And you can also block NTLM authentication at the reverse proxy if you want, as opposed to internally. Okay, so what about restricting clickable links? So, that's something you might want to look into, is to restrict that. Link provides that functionality. It's enabled in the intelligent IAM filter, which you can enable on the Edge server, so that when somebody were to send you a link, instead of clicking on it, they'll try to click, and it won't work, because sometimes users, you know, just instinctively just click on it. So what they'll have to do is they'll have to copy and paste it to get it to work. And there's a link to the documentation at the bottom there for your reference. So client authentication. Let's take a look at that. So I'm just going to summarize what we just saw in the demos here, is that Link authenticates users using NTLM over SIP. Now, again, this is on the external. If you're internally, then they'll use Kerberos for authentication. But if you're external, then it's going to use NTLM if it's the first time, that if it doesn't have a certificate. It'll also authenticate the user using NTLM over the web HTTPS to EWS. Link will then, once it's logged in, Link will then request a self-signed certificate from the Link server over HTTPS traffic. We saw that going there over the web traffic. And then once it has a certificate and it's stored in the personal store, every subsequent login will be using TLS over DSK. TLS DSK authentication, which is certificate-based authentication. So that's the Link client. What about the browser? The browser authenticates the user using basic auth over HTTPS. There are the fields, and I was looking for that there, but I couldn't seem to find it. But I know they're there. And it'll store, you know, those credentials in the credentials manager as well. For Link mobile clients, same thing. We talked about this. Link mobile clients will authenticate to Link server over using NTLM authentication over HTTPS. So it actually doesn't use SIP traffic at all. So all the signaling and all the IAM information all goes through web traffic. It's all HTTPS. So if you're thinking, oh, I need to protect my Edge server, do I need to use an Edge server to allow my Link mobile clients to authenticate? The answer is no, because it's not in the path at all, period. So, and that's to this gentleman who was asking. So if you have Link mobile clients, do not block NTLM authentication, at least at the reverse proxy level or internally, because otherwise your Link mobile clients will not be able to log in. Okay. So best practices. Let's close on saying, you know, you want to keep your system, you know, security patches up to date. That's the number one rule, right? So always keep them up to date. You never know what's happening. There's always something that's going to go. You may have a zero-day attack, so you want to make sure you keep your servers up to date. So security patches are really, really important. I just heard today, I think it was Google. Actually, Google announced that they were actually following, no, sorry, it was Apple. They were following Microsoft's best practices in terms of security patches. So that's interesting to know. You want to know your ports and protocols, right? So things to help you with that is the protocol poster, the app, the spreadsheet to help you understand what those ports and protocols, what they're used for. And then you want to configure your firewall rules properly with the knowledge of these ports and protocols that are used by Link. Then you can also configure additional protection at the edge. We talked about that, like the security web filters, security filter, the intelligent IAM filter, and then, you know, turning on or off the anonymous access. And then you want to tighten your external access to your corporate network. So we talked about, you know, using BitLocker, forcing the users to authenticate to Link through TLS DSK instead of NTLM. Those are some of the ways you can enforce that, since in light of no two-factor authentication. And then last but not least, which is really important when you're trying to deal with security, is monitor everything, okay? And create a baseline. So you want to create a baseline of what looks to be normal in your network. And then that way, that will help you monitor and give you an idea whether you're under attack or not, because you'll see for things that are different. So that's what you want to look for. I left here my contact information as well as NextHop. NextHop.info is just a redirect URL to a more complicated URL that points to the NextHop community, which has a lot of great technical articles about information. Dr. Rez is the big star there. on it, and on the right-hand side is some information. There was a hand up over here. I'd be glad to take your question, or this is it. I want to, before I close, I'd like to please thank you for coming. These were all the sessions around Link that happened here at TechEd, and there's a lot of information that's available. And please make sure you provide your evals. Those, as Thomas Vinder said earlier this morning, those are really important. And I'd be glad to take your questions afterwards. Thank you.